Hello, Sean here. Welcome back to another episode of Dilettantery. Welcome back to episode 2, talking about cave art and prehistoric art, stuff like that. Last episode, 3.1, we talked about a lot. It was a super long episode. And one of the main things we went over was this phenomenon of the camera obscura. This sort of a generalized form of what our eyes do. And the idea that it's likely that natural, accidental occurrences of this phenomenon had been witnessed throughout prehistory. We talked about how Matt Gatton, one of the main researchers of this hypothesis, said that it could have been a factor, a cause, somehow involved in the development of religion and metaphysical thought. I mentioned that he also speculated that it could have been foundational for the origin of art as well, but I didn't explain that too much, except for the part about plaquettes, because I thought it would be a good way to start this episode, because I really disagree with it, but I disagree with it in a way that it opens up, you know, a lot more to talk about. So we're going to look at that idea, and then a whole bunch of different theories of cave art that blow it to smithereens. Well, actually, this episode will be sort of zooming out of the caves, looking at all forms of prehistoric art, before going back down into the caves again next episode with some very strange and confusing philosophy. A big question people face when thinking about how art originated is how people developed the notion that things can be represented. It's kind of a weird thing to think about, it's pretty abstract, but the problem goes like this. A person only tries to artistically represent something, like a bison on a cave wall, if they already know that artistic representation is possible. So some researchers really dig into this question, trying to figure out, you know, what might have been that spark that led to this this notion that you can represent things, that you can make a bison on a wall that is a bison, but also isn't a bison, you know? One answer comes from archaeo-optics and the camera obscura studies. Some, like Matt Gatton, have suggested that an accidental camera obscura projection could be the thing that provided the spark, that by showing a representation of the outside world to some people in their tent, some people lost to history, those people learned that one could represent things in the world. Cambridge professor Nigel Spivey said that the camera obscura situation described would be, quote, a prototypical visual experience that triggers the concept of representation, unquote. This idea, not the idea of the camera obscura providing the spark, but this idea that there is a spark in general, it's very much tied to this idea of what's called the creative explosion. We'll talk about it more later, but it's this idea that this thing called the creative explosion occurred, according to most, around 35,000 to 50,000 years ago. Like, think about Chauvet Cave, for example. The idea is that there was a burst of creativity and symbolic development and technological invention around this time that included much more complex art than anything in the existing evidence of earlier humanity, something that really propelled us into sort of modern humanity or whatever. We're going to poke some holes in this theory as we go through the episode, but just wanted to mention that up top. But back to camera obscura. Matt Gatton says, quote, a randomly projected image stands for a real object. It says bison without being a flesh and blood bison, planting the idea of a referent, the conceptual beginning of art, unquote. So, as you might expect, I am, of course, very much drawn to this idea. I think it's super cool, and would love to see more theorizing and experimentation about it take place in the future, or hear about texts that I haven't come across yet, and about the subject. But this view of art seems pretty weird to me. In my opinion, and I'd love to hear what you think, but I think there's two main problems with it. It's way too focused on representational art, first of all, and secondly, it seems to think about the origin of art in a much too rationalistic way. Like, I don't think that's how humans work. One day they don't know they can represent things in the world, and then the world shows them representation, and then they're like, oh, well, thank you for the idea, world. Now I shall represent things myself. Like, it's way too rationalist for me, as though development in thought relies on, like, units of information being acquired, like you're at a supermarket or something. And it just seems way too simplistic. Like, there's one thing that's a cause, and then one thing that's an effect, and that effect is art? Something found worldwide, throughout all cultures and histories. We talked last episode that various things, including local environment, make seeing camera obscura effects more or less likely. So it'd be weird if that's like the spark that led to art throughout the world. People have all these weird aspects to them that seem a more likely culprit to me, like pareidolia, for example. That thing where your brain makes you see faces in things that weren't designed to look like faces, like a sink faucet that looks like two eyes and a nose, or a tree that has its bark in a particular face-like way. Of course, it's possible that this is a result of being familiar with representation already. Right? Maybe pareidolia and similar cognitive phenomena are a result of living in a world already brimming with representations. On our phones, in our newspapers, on the billboards, yada yada yada. Maybe pareidolia and similar things are more a result of living in a world with representations, not a cause of our theoretical invention of representation. Like, I wonder if it's cross-cultural. Like, I wonder if hunter-gatherers who don't have much in the way of representational imagery or art also have that phenomenon. Like, do they turn around startled and, you know, expecting to see a face, but it's just a bush? Just instinctively, the idea of representation arising from cognitive phenomena like that makes a lot more sense to me than Gatton's idea. E. H. Gombrich, a famous art historian, once said, quote, "The artist's gift is of this order. They are the person who has learned to look critically, to probe their perceptions by trying alternative interpretations, both in play and in earnest. Long before painting achieved the means of illusion, humans were aware of ambiguities in the visual field and had learned to describe them in language. Similes, metaphors, the stuff of poetry, no less than of myth, testify to the powers of the creative mind to create and dissolve new classifications. It is the unpractical person, the dreamer whose response may be less rigid and less sure than that of his more efficient fellow, who taught us the possibility of seeing a rock as a bull and perhaps a bull as a rock." An artist of our own day, Georges Braque, has recently spoken of the thrill and awe with which he discovered the fluidity of our categories, the ease with which a file can become a shoehorn, a bucket, a brassier. Unquote. I think that's a really cool way of looking at it. Art arising from the human tendency to play around with categorization. I think that's a lot of thinking, too. People fall into the trap of thinking about thinking, as though human thought is just computation, but there's definitely a creative aspect in thought, too, that involves boundaries of categories being fluid. An example might be us having the concept of a mother, someone who gives birth to us and ideally nurtures us as we're young, and then at some point, someone was a little creative with the boundaries of that category of mother, and they were like, hey, wait a second. We all individually have mothers, but every human lives on this thing called the Earth, which gave birth to our species and which nurtures us in a way by providing the means for life. And then out of that came the concept of Mother Earth. Like, that's definitely not exactly how it happened. The Mother Earth concept goes back really far. But this is a simplified example, just to show how thinking often involves a similar fluidity to what Gombrich describes as the artist's gift, especially thinking of new things. Like, it's very rare, I think, that a new concept just pops up out of nowhere. Usually, it's an extension of a previous thing, or a combination of a few previous things. Like how podcast is a broadcast for iPods, you know? The artist is probably just a little bit more creative in this way. or at least a good artist. So we were wondering about the origins of art, but maybe the real question is whether humans have always had a certain level of creativity, or, well, not always, but, you know, if we had a certain level of creativity that predated this creative explosion by quite a bit, or if that creativity had to be spurred by something that made it explode, like perhaps those camera obscura effects. And let's think back to that question we had earlier about pareidolia, because that very much involves this sort of blurring of categories, right? That bark looks like a face, but it's not a face, but it looks like it. Like, do hunter-gatherers who aren't surrounded by representations sometimes turn around and, you know, expecting to see a face that they saw out of the corner of their eye, only to realize that it was just some branches and leaves that happened to organize themselves in a face-like way? From what I can find out by briefly looking into this, it does seem like it's a universal human trait, developing in infants at around 10 months. So that's cool. But even cooler, according to a study by Jessica Tobert and her colleagues from 2007, rhesus monkeys experience pareidolia. So there's a species of monkeys that also see faces in face-like shapes. And of course, rhesus monkeys, as far as we know, don't create representational art. So it seems like, based on this, that pareidolia came before representational art. That quote I read from E.H. Gombrich talked about how the artist was the person who saw the rock as a bull, and the bull as a rock. In other words, a non-facial pareidolia. We can connect this to the evidence that prehistoric artists often utilized specific features of the rock as part of the figures, like using a ridge on the rock, wall as a horse's back, you know, that sort of thing. So in the art, there's evidence of this kind of thing happening. There's evidence that these artists experienced that categorical fluidity that George Brock talked about, where a rock was a rock, but also something else at the same time. There's an even more specific example, too, from one of the ancestors of modern humans, Australopithecus, from 3 million years ago. At this site in South Africa in 1974, a study found a red pebble that the researchers think was brought back to the settlement by these Australopithecus 3 million years ago, because it looks uncannily like a face. So we've slowly been poking holes in Matt Gatton's theory, and well, not just his theory about the origin of art, but sort of how he was coming at the question. And we're slowly going to build up a different answer to this question that doesn't primarily involve caves or proto-cinema or anything we talked about last episode. But I think it's a really cool explanation, first of all. And it's also a really good way to get grounded, because there's all sorts of stuff that I realized when writing this episode that I didn't think about before when thinking about art. Right? This question, what is the origin of art, seems like a, you know, basic question that we should investigate and answer and stuff, but there's lots of hidden assumptions in that question. You know, this answer that we're going to build up through this episode, it's a pretty mind-blowing way to think about this question of what is the origin of art, because it doesn't accept the question. It questions the question, which is often a more interesting way to answer a question, but also, you know, often more annoying also. The idea is this. The idea is that it's wrong to talk about the origin of art, or the invention of art, because humans are, by their nature, artistic, in a way. This isn't like some theory that everybody has like a secret Leonardo da Vinci inside themselves that they just have to release. Everybody's an artist if you try hard enough. It doesn't mean everybody's artistic in that way. It means something a lot more interesting, first of all. Maybe a good way to get settled into this way of thinking is to quote Joseph Tare, who says, quote, "The very concept of the birth or origin of art may seem inappropriate because humans are, by their nature, artists, and the history of art begins with that of humanity." unquote. So, yeah, it's not exactly every single individual is an artist, but it's just that art doesn't have an invention. It kind of is kind of invented as humans were invented. That's the sort of idea. We're gonna dig into this a lot. And we're gonna look at a few different ways of explaining this idea, coming to this conclusion that art has no real origin or invention. And there's a few ways to tackle this that I know of, and probably more that I don't know of. So, as always, if you have any relevant suggestions for texts, let me know. I mean, what we just talked about after that E.H. Gombrich quote about art arising from human categories being fluid, and that fluidity being an aspect of thought as well, not just art, that's already one way into this sort of thinking. Essentially, humans are by their nature creative, and out of this inherent creativity comes art and the artistic sensibility. Let's dive in and take a look at a few explanations of human prehistory that come to this conclusion, and deepen it in a way that also deepens our understanding of cave art. The first one is what Tare was referencing, a 2007 paper by Michel Lorblanchet, a very well-known French cave art researcher. Lorblanchet has a problem with a lot of the most famous cave researchers throughout the 20th century, and how they see human history as millions of years old, but then something happened around 35,000 to 5,000 years ago, depending on who you ask, somewhere around there, that led to art suddenly appearing. Some sort of change in cognition. Sure, there are notches and scratches and shapes and tools that are dated to a much earlier time period, but these pale in comparison to the glory of Chavez and Altamira and similar caves. Right, this is the event we talked about earlier, the creative explosion hypothesis. Another problem Lorblanchet has is that these are often universal theories. Theories that look at cave art, usually focusing on the cave art of France and Spain, and then going, this is a theory of prehistoric art, as though there was only one single form and cause and understanding of prehistoric art that took place all over the world for tens or hundreds of thousands of years. You know, it's something that doesn't really make sense to me either. Essentially, this idea says that there was some sort of creative spark that occurred when Homo sapiens settled in Western Europe. Lorblanchet says, quote, these viewpoints contain certain implicit ideas, with ethnocentric undertones, art as progress, figurative and naturalistic, proves the supremacy of the modern humans that we are, Western humans even more especially, if we push the argument to the limits it suggests. From there, we come quite naturally to think there is a cradle of art, which can only be European. The progression of Paleolithic forms assumes a time arrow clearly pointing towards us. In addition, these traditional views imply a reductive definition of art. Art can only exist in visual figuration and representation of the real or imagined world. Paleolithic art even confirms the fact that, from its origin, the prime function of art was to represent the real. Unquote. So there was a lot there. One thing in that passage is that Lorblanchet puts forth another reason to doubt the camera obscura hypothesis for the origin of art. This idea that art is representational art, art that tries to represent something that exists in the world. Of course, you know, people who emphasize representational art, they'll say that, you know, the other visual art, abstract art and geometric shapes and patterns and stuff, yeah, that's technically art, I guess, but it's kind of boring compared to the representational art. We don't have to think about it too much, we can push it to the side. This emphasis on representational art is a thing in Western thinking that goes all the way back to Plato and his view of mimesis and stuff. Don't worry about what that is, but the point is that it's very ingrained in Western thought and academia. We can see it in Gatton's theory. Gatton's theory is a great example. It makes sense, you know, if you accept the camera hypothesis, camera obscura hypothesis, you know, axioms and stuff. You know, that might make sense for naturalistic representational art. like the lions on the walls of Chavez, but it completely ignores the other forms of art that are found right beside the representational art on the cave walls. And then it has the audacity to claim to be a theory of the origin of art. That question we started the episode with is emblematic of this way of thinking, saying that the major question concerning the origin of art is how people got the idea that they could represent things in the world. The major question is how humans got the notion that representation is possible. But that's sidelining so much of human art in general. We'll continue to pick apart this notion as the episode progresses, as well as next episode. This, you know, first off, there's the heightening of representational art. That's something we'll look at a lot this episode. And then next episode, we'll talk about how this dichotomy between representational art and abstract art, you know, maybe that dichotomy blinds us to certain ways of thinking that can help us understand prehistoric art better. Another thing Lord Blanchet mentioned in that passage is the Eurocentrism of that theory, the theory of the creative explosion put forth by 20th century European intellectuals. So, you know, this doesn't make this idea false, but something that raises both my and Lord Blanchet's suspicions is that this theory came about when academia was a lot more openly ethnocentric in the early 20th century, and it kind of says that modern humans, the first apes that were fully human, got started in Western Europe, right? It's kind of like the ethnocentric narrative that was dominant in early 20th century academia and still among many people today. Just a prehistoric version of it, right? Like, instead of the Enlightenment and modern science and stuff like that making Europeans more rational and intelligent than anyone else on the Earth, it's prehistoric Europeans creatively exploding and creating art, making them fully human, making them more human than anyone else on the planet. So again, I'm not mentioning this as a solid, thorough argument against this hypothesis, but it is something that makes me go, and look for holes in it. Look for other explanations. Look for contextualizations of how this theory came about. Like, whenever a theory or a history or a fact is developed by a person or a culture, and that theory or history or fact really resonates with that person or culture's beliefs, it only makes sense to be a little bit more skeptical than otherwise, right? And it's true. Any basic up-to-date history of art will tell you that the birth and history of art, according to the current archaeological evidence, is a thing that happened all over the world. This doesn't mean it happened everywhere that people were. For example, there's significant regions of Asia and America without any evidence of anything that would be called art, but with evidence of human habitation for millennia. All that it means is that it seems like it was a dispersed phenomenon. It wasn't just invented in one place and then spread outwards from that point, like the alphabet, for example. Because, for example, there's also significant regions of America and Asia and Africa that do have evidence of it without, you know, those cultures talking to each other. Just so we have something tangible, let's just go over two examples. We'll cover more in a bit. But in Indonesia, the oldest representational rock art ever found was discovered recently, in 2017. It's of this sort of pig creature, and there's all these half-human, half-animal figures that are hunting it or, you know, involved with it in some way. And then nearby in Australia, Australia is full of cave art, the earliest of which dates to 10,000 years before Chavez. In both Australia and Europe, available evidence shows a gap of many thousands of years between the arrival of humans and the creation of cave art. Something interesting. Anyways, another thing Lord Blanchet attacks in this 2007 paper is the traditional notion that European Paleolithic art exists in a linear trajectory from simple to complex, saying that the evidence shows, first of all, a wide variety of forms of art, including stuff we haven't talked about much in this series, like prehistoric statuettes, like the famous Lion Man, if you want to Google that. And second of all, the evidence also shows complexity and simplicity existing together. In other words, there's not this clear temporal linear progression from simple marks to complex cave art of Chavet or whatever. The evidence doesn't show anything like that. The variety of forms and styles found in prehistoric art makes it hard to believe in theories of the origin of art that have a linear trajectory or are monocausal, like Gatton's. There's the murals of animals at Chavet, compared to the repeated vulvas engraved in the Vézère Valley, for example, or just the difference between the painting and engraving on the walls and the statuettes, like the aforementioned Lion Man, that cropped up around the same time. And, alongside these, there are caves with just parallel lines engraved or other similarly, basic geometric shapes. In other words, all these different forms of art really make me question Gatton's claim that he found the origin of art. Like, I can definitely see camera obscura effects being involved, but for there just to be one cause of such diverse forms seems a little questionable to me. So, to summarize, the available evidence doesn't show a development of art in prehistoric Europe that's akin to the artistic development of a child, learning art first resulting in scribbles, then basic shapes, then badly proportioned representations, then more and more refined. No, from the evidence we have, European Paleolithic art is a muddle, akin to how visual art is in our society today. Some people being geniuses, masters creating masterpieces, and some not quite as spectacular, maybe trying for glory and failing, maybe just doodling random stuff on their page as they wait for the bell at the end of class. This doesn't mean that there weren't any of those trajectories from simple to complex. Like maybe specific cultures refined their artistic talents over the generations. Maybe in Lasso or Chavet, the first animals painted are usually the most rudimentary ones. I'm not sure. This just means that when you look at Paleolithic Western Europe as a whole, the trajectory isn't there. And then when you broaden this to encompass the entire world, you see a similar thing, Laura Blanchet says. In Australia, the earliest art shows representative art of humans and animals in Arnhem Land in the Northeast, alongside geometric art and finger tracings that exist in many locations across Australia, a lot of which is called the Panaramiti style. In India, the earliest art is from 10,000 years ago, and again, there's so-called simple geometric shapes and lines alongside naturalistic, representational, so-called complex art, like the ones that show rows of dancers, about which Indian rock art specialist Erwin Neumeier said, quote, "One of the world's richest sources of information about the performing arts in prehistoric times is the painted decoration on the walls of caves in central India. Here, early artists created some of the most vivid and dramatic pictures of people in motion." Unquote. In Africa, the oldest rock art is found in a cave in Namibia, dated to 25,000 years ago, roughly, and is a representative image of some sort of animal or animal-like figure, drawn not on a wall but on a portable stone slab. The archaeologist Jürgen Richter called it a, quote, "therianthrope combining a feline body, human hind legs, and oryx horns," unquote. When I look at it, I do not see that, but maybe it changes when you're in person. Later on, close to Namibia, in the neighboring South Africa, there's lots of rock art from 6,000 to 2,000 years ago, but it starts out with naturalistic, representative art, and over the years gets gradually more and more geometric. So kind of the opposite of this, hypothesized trajectory of progress. In the Sahara, again, there's rock art, simple and complex, representative and geometric, existing alongside each other, again, not in a clear trajectory of simple to complex. And beyond all this, there are vast periods in all continents when humans lived, but did not leave any paintings or engravings on walls or rocks. We will come back to Lord Blanchet eventually, but let's take a detour first and look at a phenomenon existing in many hunter-gatherer cultures, something that's been observed many times in the written record. The anthropologist William Buckner has written a paper called Disguises and the Origin of Clothing, where he makes the really interesting point that we generally have a monocausal view of clothing. Most people, you know, normal people as well as experts, think that clothing was invented to regulate temperature better. End of story. They rarely imagine any other uses. Buckner, however, has uncovered tons of evidence of hunter-gatherers using clothing as camouflage or disguise when hunting, or when trying to hide, whether from animals or other people. Most of the evidence has to do with hunting, though. Buckner says, quote, "Hunter-gatherer disguises exhibit similarities to examples of visual deception found in other species, commonly involving strategies of animal mimicry, masquerade, background matching, or disruptive coloration, and often used to pursue prey or avoid attack." Unquote. So, in other words, Buckner's making an analogy to the animal world, right? There's so many animals that mimic other animals or other things or camouflage themselves. Butterflies with fake giant eyes in their wings to scare off predators, insects that look exactly like leaves or sticks, anglerfish with a dangling light to attract other deep-sea fish, animals colored in such a way that they blend into their typical natural environment. I'm sure you can think of many examples. And what Buckner is saying is that there's kind of an analogy here. Many of the human cultures that, you know, live more enmeshed in the natural world, I guess you could say, or, you know, ones where everyone's involved in the food web, you know, or cultures where hunting is an everyday thing. He's saying that those humans employ many similar strategies to animals in nature, but instead of being due to, you know, just the creativity of evolution, as you might say, for those animal examples, it's due to the creativity of humans and cultures. And I should mention, before we move on, that these weren't the only reasons they created camouflage for themselves. Some also did it for reasons connected to their cosmologies, you know, what we'd call religion. We'll get there. But first, let's look at some specific examples, all posted by William Buckner on his Twitter page, which is a great follow, at evolving_Moloch. You know Moloch?
Moloch, whose eyes are 1,000 blind windows. Moloch, whose factories dream and croak in the fog.
That guy? Anyways, his blog, traditionsofconflict.com, is also really cool. So let's go over some examples, and let's start with the most basic form, the most basic form of this type of deception, and work our way up in complexity. The most basic type is camouflage, right? Just when you make clothes that match the background so you blend in. It's like the more culturally specific definition of camouflage, right? Camo, used by the army. But examples in other cultures are like the Inuit, who have been known to wear white clothing when seal hunting to blend into the snow and ice. Similar with the Tlingit to the south in southern Alaska, and further south still with the Assiniboine in Montana, where it still snows enough, or at least it once did, to employ white parkas to blend into nature when hunting in the winter. The Naganasin of Siberia wear reindeer skin that's very similar in color to the rocks of the region, allowing them to blend in. And the Amahuaca of Peru smear themselves with a juice from this specific fruit that turns black after an hour, which makes them really blend into the surrounding jungle underbrush. But it gets more complex. The Selknam of Tierra del Fuego, the bottom tip of South America, paint themselves to mimic tree trunks, to disguise themselves when hunting guanaco. These animals closely related to llamas. But the Selknam also use disguise and deception when hunting seals. And this is really cool. They make fake seal pups out of stuffed seal skin. And The Selkim Hunters would combine this visual deception with an auditory deception. They would become skilled in mimicking the cries of a baby seal. So, you know, they'd use the fake seal pup and these cries to attract adults to the fake baby, bringing them into a vulnerable position to be killed easier. Traveling north of Tierra del Fuego, getting to the more forested regions, the lower Amazon, there's some other cultural disguises, like there's a photograph of a hunter from the Inkset people of western Paraguay, disguised as a bush, wearing leaves and branches strapped into his back. The Chirote of Argentina have been observed also using this hunting trick. According to an ethnography from 1961 on the Innu people living around Lake Melville in Labrador, Canada, so eastern Canada near Newfoundland, the Innu use camouflage. It's really cool. I'll read the ethnography's description of it. It says, quote, "To hunt aquatic fowl, natives camouflage themselves and their canoes with white tenting to simulate floating ice. When there is no canvas, Innu use spruce boughs in imitation of floating trees, which are carried out in great numbers due to high waters and spring erosion," unquote. So they simulate like mini icebergs with their canoes to hunt water birds. And then they also use something similar to the Selknam. The Innu also hunt a seal by stuffing a seal skin and hiding behind it to approach the seal as it pokes its head above the water to breathe through the holes in the ice. So kind of similar to the Selknam stuffing of a seal skin, but also used in a different way, right? Not to lure, but to disguise oneself as you crawl towards a seal. South of the Innu, the Ojibwa in southeastern Canada, northeastern US, they also use camouflage. When they hunt traditionally, scouts go out ahead of the hunters to try to figure out where the animals are, and these scouts would wear headdresses of grass so that when they lie flat, whatever was in front of them couldn't see them. They'd just blend in with the rest of the prairies. The Pomo of California wear deer masks for camouflage when hunting deer. The Dahomey, the subjects of that Woman King movie that's out recently, they hunt elephants by disguising themselves as antelope, wearing horns that stick ominously out above the tall grass as they make their approach. The Yaruros of Venezuela have a more creative camouflage when hunting deer. They paint themselves white, paste feathers onto their bodies, wear a black mask that has a beak and a red band around its neck. And this is exactly how the Jabaro stork looks, a species of bird in the area. So the Yaruro hunter, wearing this camouflage, they move in a... they try to match the movement of the stork, kind of moving in a bird-like way towards the deer, until the hunter gets close enough to shoot an arrow at it. The Yaruro use really heavy arrows, presumably for a more sure kill when combined with this method of mimicry and camouflage, deception. I really like when these camouflages and disguises involve species that aren't the species hunting or being hunted. Like, they're dressing up as a bird to hunt this animal. I don't know, just kind of interesting symbioses. Unintentional symbioses. Similar bird disguises are used by the Auen Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert in Botswana and the Arente people of Central Australia, who mimic ostriches and emus respectively, using long sticks for their necks and then making a fake beak and head at the top out of various things. Sometimes this was used to hunt ostriches and emus, sometimes to hunt other animals. The Chukchi of Siberia, who we talked about in episode 1.31, have a really cool form of camouflage used to, again, hunt seals with. But something about seals really brings out the creativity in people, I guess. The anthropologist Vladimir Bogoraz describes it. He says, quote, In the spring, when the seals come up to the surface of the snow to bask in the sun, another method of hunting is adopted. The hunter puts on a special hunting dress, consisting of a short shirt of reindeer skin, worn with the fur side next to the body and the gray inner skin outside. As the Chukchi have no sealskin coats, this serves as the nearest imitation, in appearance, of the seal. A special cap is fastened on the head, in imitation of the seal muzzle, with two round black pieces for eyes. The left elbow and knee, sometimes both knees, are protected by square pieces of polar bear skin to prevent friction and to keep off the moisture of the melting snow. Whenever the left hand is raised, the protecting piece acts like a white screen, helping to conceal the hunter from his prey. As soon as the animal is sighted, the sealer begins to creep toward it, from the windward side, armed with a long shaft or harpoon, or, more rarely, with a gun. He proceeds very slowly, imitating the motions of the seal, and from time to time scratching the snow, as the seal does, with a wooden scratcher tipped with seal claws. When the seal lifts its head, the hunter immediately falls still, and does not proceed until the seal lies down again. Gradually, he approaches so close to the seal as to be able to play the harpoon. Unquote. So the Chukchi have developed this very complex costume to disguise themselves when hunting seals. A costume that has a part coming from reindeer, the reindeer skin, a part coming from polar bear, the polar bear skin that prevents friction and moisture, and then part coming from a seal, right? Is the seal arm, these claws. Very complex costume, and lots of attention to detail, like making an arm of a seal to scratch the snow with, as the seal does. Very impressive description. You can really see how hunting techniques like this would, you know, kind of maybe contribute to the evolution of mind that brought us to modern humanity, right? Anyways, Bogras says that a similar tactic is used by the Inuit on the other side of the Arctic Ocean. And even more complex disguises are created. Ones that involve spirits, for example. The Arrente of Australia have shoes that assassins use to change their footprints into the shape of a particular malevolent spirit being's footprints. So it looks like the dead was killed by the spirit, you know, not another person. Really cool stuff. Archaeological evidence of decoy use goes back 2,000 years in the Americas and 3,000 years in Micronesia in the Western Pacific. Buckner suggests that hunting cultures living in more open environments are more likely to create disguises and camouflage, for obvious reasons. Another trend Buckner noticed was that the disguises weren't of all animals. Buckner says, quote, "The specific animal disguises used in hunting contexts in this sample consisted of bears, buffalo, caribou, emu, seals, wolves, along with jaguar and sea lion disguises in cult contexts, which tend to be larger and perhaps more imitable for humans than small or mid-game or fish, which some of the societies that don't employ animal disguises tend to specialize." Unquote. So, in other words, people generally dress up as animals that are roughly the same size as them. Yeah, it would be funny to dress up as a fish to try to fish. It's a funny image. But why am I talking about all this? We were talking about, you know, art and all that. Well, we were talking about how humans are maybe artistic by their very nature. In these examples that Buckner provides, humans who live very... I love saying that hunter-gatherers live traditionally, but, you know, humans who lived as close as possible to how we presume humans in the Paleolithic did, they develop quite complex forms of mimicry and disguise. And oftentimes these disguises find their way deeper into culture. They're used in rituals. I mentioned that jaguar and the sea lion in that passage of Buckner's I read. But 4 of the 10 societies that Buckner looked at in this paper used disguises in rituals, and 3 used musical instruments alongside the disguises to mimic the voices of the spirits involved. So think about it. These are highly creative acts that often blend deeper into society beyond the efficacious, beyond the practical, beyond merely a tool used to obtain sustenance, and into the ritual, the cosmic. But I'm not saying here that hunter disguises and mimicry led to art in this linear way. Right? Remember we started out this episode talking about the idea that camera obscura effects could be the spark that led to the birth of art? And I'm not trying to find a different spark. I'm not saying that hunter mimicries and disguises, that was the spark that led to art. We're trying to critique that whole idea of there being a spark in the first place. And to do that, we need to add one more ingredient. So keep the hunter disguises in mind. We're going to go away from that and take a closer look at the word art. Just to introduce this, I'm going to read a short quote from the philosopher Larry Shiner, who said, quote, "The modern system of art is not an essence or fate, but something we've made. Art as we have generally understood it is a European invention barely 200 years old. It was preceded by a broader, more utilitarian system of art that lasted for over 2,000 years and is likely to be followed by a third system of the arts." Unquote. In other words, art is a concept that isn't universal. What we mean by art is sometimes very similar to what it means in other languages and cultures, but sometimes it's quite different. Some cultures don't have a word for it, for example, even though it's something they do. They just do it. They don't go, "I'm going to do an art today." They just, you know, it's often conceived of in some way very enmeshed in their particular cosmology, their particular worldview, you know, various, you know, what we call like spirit beings or gods and stuff. The scholar Ellen Desaniaki says, quote, "When contemporary philosophers of art make the radical and rather astonishing statement that art has existed for only two centuries, they are referring to the insufficiently appreciated fact that the abstract concept art is a construction of Western culture and in fact has a discernible historical origin. It was only in the late 18th century, in Enlightenment England and Germany, and subsequently, that the subject of aesthetics was named and developed, that the aesthetic came to be regarded as a distinctive kind of experience, and that an art world of academies, museums, galleries, dealers, critics, journals, and scholars arose to address a type of human artifact that was made primarily, and often specifically, for acquisition and display. At the same time, ideas of genius, creative imagination, self-expression, originality, communication, and emotion, having originated in other contexts, became increasingly and even primarily or exclusively associated with the subject of art. The word art, as used before the late 18th century, meant what we would today call craft or skill or well-madeness, and could characterize any object or activity made or performed by human, rather than natural or divine, agency. For example, the art of medicine, of retailing, of holiday dining." Unquote. So those two quotes are pretty interesting. The modern system of art is only 200 years old, and there's other systems of art, other understandings of the concept. It's pretty interesting, but it might seem like a weird claim to you if you haven't read too much, you know, anthropology or history that's focused on art and how different cultures relate to it. Because I'm sure a bunch of you, when I said that art as a modern concept is only 200 years old, I'm assuming many of you like thought about a church that was, you know, painted with beautiful frescoes in the year 500 AD, or you know, art from the Maori or the Inuit or something that you've seen in a museum called art. So, you know, doesn't the museum know what they're talking about? Well, André Malraux, in his book Museum Without Walls, provides a good way to strengthen our understanding of this. He creates a dichotomy that every single art object falls within. He makes a distinction between art by destination and art by metamorphosis. Art by destination is art that was made by someone who was consciously making it as art. And art by metamorphosis is when something was created for a different reason, but is now seen as art, in at least our society. So if you go to a paint store, buy a few paintbrushes and some paint and some blank paper, and you go home and paint a picture of a tree, the painting of the tree is art by destination. The whole way through, you are consciously thinking, I'm going to make art, I am making art, I have made art. The painting of the tree was destined to be art from the beginning. That's why it's called art by destination. But the other form of art, art by metamorphosis, might be a little harder to think of an example for. So let's try to imagine an example from Western culture before broadening it out to the rest of the world. I'm gonna speculate a lot here, but just bear with me. This is just to think about the concept, not history, okay? Think about portraits, for example. I'm not 100% sure about this, completely speculating, but I wonder if painted portraits of families or, you know, spouses or individuals, I wonder if that was understood to be art in the era before photography. Like, I can definitely imagine it being viewed in that way, but I can also imagine it being conceptualized otherwise, because the goal, from what I assume, is not just to create something pretty, something aesthetic. It seems to me like the goal with that sort of stuff is like to create an image of a family that lasts longer than they do, a way to uphold memory or to solidify a snapshot of life, something like that. Maybe a better way to say this is that the specific people in it are what's important, not the portrait's composition and choice of color and stuff. Like I can imagine a family from the 1600s time traveling to the 21st century and seeing their family portrait in a museum and going, wait, what? Why is it in a museum? You don't even know us. What are you doing? If this is how portraits were seen, then this imagined portrait of the 17th century family now hanging in a museum, that would be an example of art by metamorphosis. This portrait was created not with aesthetics in mind, not to be art, but instead with that specific family in mind, trying to make an aid for memory or, you know, something like that. Of course, maybe my speculations are wrong. I just wanted to get an example of painting in there. But another example would be if someone made a really nice looking, ornate chair in the 1100s for some monarch to sit upon. And then if you fast forward to the 21st century, that chair is sitting in a museum, and there's a little plaque next to it saying that it's a remarkable example of so-and-so style. Right? It was created for someone just to sit upon, but then over the centuries was transformed, metamorphosed into an art object. And nowadays, if you decide to sit on it, the museum security guard will tackle you and call the police. So it's complete transition, complete metamorphosis. Now, you might not be fully on board yet. You might be thinking, hold on. You said the chair was ornately designed. You said it was made in a specific style. You said it was made to look pretty. So clearly it was partially aesthetic or artistic, even though it was also functional, used for sitting. Right? I think that this isn't a clear dichotomy between art by destination and art by metamorphosis. Like, if you make something as basic as a chair in a way that is pretty, that has a style, has ornate designs upon it, then I think that art is sort of hiding in there, right? Or the chair was created with function and art alongside each other, something like that. I don't know if any of you are thinking that, but I think that's kind of a natural reaction to this idea, but only because we live in a society that we live in. In industrialized societies, we have created ways of producing a fuck ton of chairs super effectively, but it's very rare for one of those chairs to really catch your eye as something aesthetic, right? Even in a millennia into the future, I really doubt that anyone will put an IKEA chair in an art museum. Maybe a museum of like industrialization, or a museum of Swedish stuff, but not an art museum, right? Well, we should keep in mind that aesthetic opinions are a lot more varied than what many people assume. Most people think of beauty as some sort of natural thing, like anyone who looks at something beautiful whether they're an oil tycoon from Texas or a hunter-gatherer from the Amazon, will in general agree that it's beautiful. There's more agreement than disagreement, in other words. But I'm often surprised at how variable it can be, it seems. I'd love more examples, of course, but one example from the West that I mentioned in Series 2 is something claimed by the historians of science Peter Dallison and Lorraine Gaston. They say, quote, "Though often lost on moderns who fetishize the handmade, there was, in the 19th century, an aesthetic pleasure in identical objects." Unquote. So in other words, if you showed an IKEA chair to someone as close culturally to me and maybe you, probably you, as a Westerner in the late 1800s, they might see it as an aesthetic thing. They might say something like, "Wow, it's so beautiful, it looks like all the other chairs." To me, and probably you, that's such a strange understanding of aesthetics, right? But just 100 years ago, an alien aesthetics reigned, at least according to these two historians. You know, maybe not reigned, but it was in there, it was in the mix. Something just as alien can pop up 100 years in the future, or 1,000, presumably. I mean, seeing Zoomers bring back certain styles from the 2000s is pretty alien to me already. From what I can tell, and of course, it's made up anyways, but I'm on like the boundary between Millennial and Zoomer. So I was in high school just after that stuff was in style, like the super baggy 2004 pants. So I was trying to figure out what was cool, right, when that was out of style, when it very much wasn't cool. But current teens are separated enough from it that it's come back as something considered cool. Pretty baffling to my tastes. Anyways, I don't know anything about fashion, so I don't know why I went on that diatribe. But that's one thing to keep in mind here. What's seen as aesthetic is more variable than most imagine, maybe. So maybe the chairs we're surrounded by in this age of global industrial capitalism, chairs that seem purely functional and not at all aesthetic, maybe they'll be seen as aesthetic someday, or by some alien invaders or whatever. But maybe you still have doubts about this dichotomy of André Malraux, art by destination and art by metamorphosis. Maybe you're still stuck on this chair example a little, and how it was crafted in an intricate style, seemingly with aesthetics in mind. Like, you might be thinking, okay, sure, the chairs I see nowadays are, you know, pretty ugly and shitty, but maybe they'll be seen as aesthetic someday by some future culture. Sure, fine, whatever. But we're talking about that, you know, 11th century chair, made for a monarch, intricately designed. Like, we were discussing whether that's art by destination or metamorphosis. I can get that it was metamorphosed into a completely artistic object, where you'll be arrested if you try to sit on it in the museum. But didn't the creator have some sense of creating art when he designed it so carefully, so detailed? Otherwise, wouldn't he have just not cared about aesthetics? Wouldn't he have just made a basic chair? Here, it would be helpful to remember back to that quote that led us onto this tangent, that passage from the philosopher Larry Shiner. I'll read it again. He says, quote, "The modern system of art is not an essence or fate, but something we've made. Art, as we have generally understood it, is a European invention, barely 200 years old. It was preceded by a broader, more utilitarian system of art that lasted over 2,000 years, and is likely to be followed by a third system of the arts." Unquote. So I think this is the missing piece of the puzzle, if you were thinking like my imagined interlocutor, at least. If you take a broad view of humanity as it has existed across time and space, the conceptualization of art that emerged in modernity is pretty weird. And only within this way of understanding art that has arisen in the last two centuries does this dichotomy of Malraux's make sense. Why is this? I'm going to give you a little time to try to think about yourself. Why does the dichotomy of art by destination and art by metamorphosis only make sense in this specific context of roughly the past two centuries? We can bring in one more scholar, the anthropologist Joseph McKay, for an answer. In his book, The Aesthetic Experience, he says, quote, "Few art objects by destination were ever made in pre-Renaissance Europe or in non-literate societies." Unquote. So, first of all, I'm not sure why he phrased it like that. I'm curious to know if there are traditions of art by destination in non-European literate societies before 1800 or so. I'd assume that you could say what McKay did, but instead of saying few art objects by destination were ever made in pre-Renaissance Europe or in non-literate societies, you could just say few art objects by destination were made in non-modern societies. But I don't know, maybe there's a reason he's saying it like that. I'd be curious about East Asia and how they viewed art before modernity. But regardless, the general point is super interesting, I think. Art by destination is a pretty rare phenomenon in most cultures. What museums and textbooks call art done by the Maori of New Zealand or the Dogon of Mali in West Africa, for example, that art was never created by someone one day going, you know what, I think I will make an art today. And from that, doing the necessary steps to make that art. But wait, if they didn't make art by destination, then did they make art by metamorphosis? That doesn't make sense either, does it? Remember, the whole point is that the dichotomy breaks down outside of modernity. Because pre-Renaissance Europe and non-literate cultures, and probably other literate ones, in history, have a very different understanding of art. Remember what Larry Shiner said? That art as we have generally understood it is a European invention barely 200 years old? But then there was that next bit where he said it was preceded by a broader, more utilitarian system of art that lasted for over 2,000 years. So let's focus on those two words there that really stuck out to me, and maybe to you as well. Shiner says that the understandings of art before and outside of modernity are more utilitarian. I, and probably you, living in a culture that has this 2 centuries old understanding of art, and not the 2 millennia old understanding of art, which I have a question about that dating too. But anyways, since I grew up in this culture, I think that this is kind of weird. Art being utilitarian? Huh? In my culture, art is usually something that's seen as taking a break from utilitarian activities, like watching a movie after work, or going to an art museum on the weekend, or reading a good novel on vacation. So what on earth is this other general way of understanding art that's more utilitarian? It seems like an odd word to associate with art, right? But this has a lot to do with how unique many aspects of modernity are compared to the rest of human history and culture. Like a big thing is secularization, what Nietzsche called the death of God, right? God is dead and we've killed him. This doesn't mean that everyone within modernity is an atheist. Far from it. There's still, over a century after Nietzsche, quite a lot of people in Western Europe and its progeny that are still quite religious, and then a whole nother significant amount of people who are spiritual but not religious. But what it means is that modernity developed this prominent alternative to religion, scientific materialism, and at the same time pushed religion more and more out of society in general and into its own box. So it's kind of interesting. What happened to religion with modernity, how modernity treats religion, is kind of similar to how it treats art. Like, it creates its own box for it. But like in medieval Europe or the Mayan Empire, what we would call religion is kind of just like the foundation of society. That's, you know, it's everywhere. It's not the separate thing that you abstract away. And similar for art, right? It would be tied up in daily life so much, creating whatever aesthetic things that any culture creates. And of course, this is a very simplistic summary too. Like, this is a very debated thing, obviously. And like, there's lots of things I'm not sure about. Like, I think there are ancient Greeks who could be seen as atheists. And, you know, there are Muslims from 1,000 years ago who sound pretty much exactly like Carl Sagan. Like, I recently found this one guy from the 10th century named Abu al-Allah al-Ma'ari, or something similar to that. And he was skeptical of religion, and he said stuff like, "The secret of the day and night is in the constellations which forever spin around each other in the comet dust. The comet dust and humankind are kin." You know, it sounds exactly like Carl Sagan. So in other words, there's all these nuances and debates. My summary here is very much a simplification, but I do think that the pushing religion out of society in general and into its own subcategory within society is a pretty unique thing that modernity has. Like, I'm just speculating here, but the skeptics of the medieval or ancient cultures seem to me to usually be more on their own, like maybe having a small following, but I think it took the existence of a comprehensive, like, alternative metaphysics, like scientific materialism, to make society in general transform itself to where religion wasn't part of the foundation of society, the fabric of everyday life. It was something that some people chose to partake in and others chose not to partake in. And again, you know, not super confident in this history, so if you disagree in a knowledgeable way, please let me know. But I do think that the question, are you religious, is one that only makes sense in a minority of human societies, at least, you know, before globalization. Think about art in these non-modern societies where religion, what we call religion, is sort of like the foundation of life, you know, where a god or many gods or many spirit beings, hard to translate, but these beings are always around, always involved in daily life of the culture. Like, are you starting to see how this art would be more utilitarian? In most human cultures, what modernity calls art was created within this context of spirits and gods and the like. So the thinking when making what we would call art would usually be kind of a tool in a way, like a method of connecting or appeasing some sort of spirit or god. The thinking of someone about to create what would be metamorphosed by modernity into art wouldn't be, I should make an art. It would be something like, I have to make this meeting place beautiful so the spirits are pleased. You know, thoughts like that. Aesthetics is involved, but aesthetics is not synonymous with art. Let's finally come back to that chair example, the guy making the chair for the monarch in the 11th century in Europe. We can imagine him making this chair beautiful, not because he was trying to make art, but because he was trying to make a chair worthy of the monarch, a chair that was so beautiful that it implied the monarch's superiority of blood when the monarch sat upon it. It is consciously an attempt to make it aesthetic, to make it attractive, but not an attempt to make it art. Is that dichotomy a little bit clearer now? I hope so. We can turn back momentarily to Lord Blanchet, who says, quote, despite the necessary care that use of the word art in prehistoric research requires, we should remember that there has never been the slightest conflict, in fact, there has always been a close association, between aesthetic function and utilitarian, religious, or magical function. Through its visual impact and its singing, religious art aims to impress believers and facilitate their communication with the divinity. In traditional art, beauty also ensures magic's effectiveness. In the brilliance of colors and forms are expressed the respect due to the forces governing the world, the effort to please, seduce, and conciliate them. Figurative or decorative beauty is above all functional. Unquote. So, if you are sad about art not being a universal thing, you can rejoice. Maybe a notion of the aesthetic is universal. Maybe there's a universal aesthetic experience. You know, of course, you know, conceptualized differently and triggered by different things and stuff, like people at the birth of industrialization being enamored by identical mass-produced things. But maybe there is this sort of universal aesthetic mode of cognition, right? If you're someone who's into universal things, maybe you can find some solace in that and think about that. And another thing we should keep in mind is that in this two-century-old understanding of art in modernity, most art is still not just an aesthetic thing. It performs other functions, like poems and songs can be aesthetic but also tell a story, or get people riled up before a hockey game, stuff like that. Or paintings can be aesthetic, but also a portrait of a family that aids memory. So that's just one more thing to keep in mind. And I think I'm going to split this episode into two to keep it a little shorter than the last one. And we're going to start out next episode continuing with this idea that there's some sort of aesthetic experience or an aesthetic mode of cognition that is universal, but conceptualization and understanding of aesthetic objects, what we call art, is not universal. We're going to start out diving into that a little bit more, because that's what that anthropologist I mentioned a bit earlier, Jacques Maquet, argues in his book, The Aesthetic Experience. And I'm not completely sure about his conclusions. His thinking still seems to be very much within modernity and stuff, and it's from the 80s, but his book brings up some really cool things that'll strengthen our understanding of art and aesthetics, and then we can end next episode returning to Laure Blanchet and hunter-gatherer disguises and all that stuff to really get to this idea of what's called Homo aestheticus. Anyways, I'll see you next episode.